So thank you all for coming, and thank you, Micah, for coming back to Sorgen to speak with us. We've had some really interesting conversations. You joined a class, and we just had an interesting meal, so I think you'll enjoy what he's about to talk about. So we're really excited to have Micah, Dr. White, speaking at Swarthmore. He is most famous for his role in Occupy Wall Street, but he was actually very involved in activism when he was a student at Swarthmore during the Iraq War. So, for example, when Diebold, an electronic voting machine producer, had internal memos leaked that suggested involvement in Republican voter fraud, Micah played a role in posting these documents to Swarthmore servers, and then this spread to other colleges and universities. Those are still up there, by the way, if you want to check those out. And in 2011, when Micah was an editor at Adbusters magazines, he helped come up with the idea and the original call for Occupy Wall Street. Nowadays, Micah runs boutique activist consultancy, writes for various news publications on the future of protest, and he recently published a book on the topic, The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. The men's magazine Esquire has named him 37 people under 35 who are reshaping the world. So, we have an interesting talk ahead of us. I want to thank everyone who helped make this event possible, and I think the number of co-sponsors is a testament to the interdisciplinary and far-reaching applications of what he's going to talk about tonight. So, I would like to thank the Swarthmore Daily Gazette, Film and Media Studies, the Lane Center for Civic and Social Responsibility, the Intercultural Center, Swarthmore Libraries, Peace and Conflict Studies, Sociology and Anthropology, Political Science, Computer Science, Environmental Studies, the Forum for Free Speech, Warner's Radio, Swarthmore Democrats, the Swarthmore Anti-Capitalist Collective, and the Swarthmore College Computer Society. So, can everyone, a warm welcome.
Wow. It is a true honor and privilege to be back here at Swarthmore to speak to you. I want to say, look, if your friends aren't here, you should text them right now and tell them to get over here, because we're going to have a very interesting discussion about revolution, okay? But first, I want to just thank Adina. I can't even comprehend how she pulled this off so professionally. I got this email from her and I was like, are you like a 25-year-old like who's done this many times? Because it was just very professional. And so thank you so much for organizing, for bringing me here, making it happen. I think you're gonna go very far in life, and I think that also people should feel empowered. If you want someone to come to Swarthmore to speak, you should just reach out to them like Adina did, and it'll happen. So thank you for bringing me here. It is a real honor and a privilege. Okay. Now, I want to show you a picture. I'm not going to show you many pictures because I personally hate PowerPoint. But I want to show you a picture. Just one picture here. Here I am in 2002 as a student at Swarthmore, running from police. And I'm on the left here, and behind me are two also Swarthmore students. We had organized a kind of bus to go to an anti-globalization protest in New York City where some Swarthmore students were arrested. We ran from police. This picture was taken by a New York Times reporter, and it was in the New York Times. So I just want to kind of show you, like, this is what I was doing when I was a student at Swarthmore, is I was literally running from police officers in anti-globalization protests and organizing anti-war protests and stuff like that. So Swarthmore, I was an activist before I came to Swarthmore, but Swarthmore played a fundamentally important role in my development as an activist. So a lot of the ideas that I'm going to be talking about were really forged on this campus, and we can have a discussion later about the role of activism on campus and all that kind of stuff. So before I get started, one thing I'd like to say is that, you know, I'm not the kind of person who wants you to agree with everything that I am going to say. And in fact, I believe that the best ideas are often the ideas that make us uncomfortable. Now, when I try to create activist campaigns, what I do is I look for ideas that make me slightly uncomfortable. I think that Occupy Wall Street was a perfect example of that. You know, the idea of people going down to Wall Street and like sleeping in the street is actually something that makes us and me uncomfortable. Even a lot of the founders of Occupy Wall Street never slept in Wall Street. The idea of sleeping in the street to protest. So I think that we're gonna touch territory now that's gonna make us uncomfortable. So what you should do though, instead of running from that uncomfortableness, make a note of it in your journal and research about it. try to figure out why that made you uncomfortable, because often the truth is somehow behind that. You know, there's something there that you need to keep researching. So we're gonna talk openly and candidly about a topic that is not openly and candidly often discussed in our country, which is the possibility of revolution. What would it look like? Why are contemporary protests seemingly ineffective? And these kind of things. And then I'm gonna say a lot of ideas, and then I'm gonna open it up. And we're gonna have a conversation. Okay. I'm gonna try to do what I had hoped speaker would have done when I was a student activist. I remember once I went to a lecture. Probably after that picture was taken of Huntington Cops, and it was a famous filmmaker or something, and I raised my hand and I said, "What do you think about the Iraq War?" You know, he looked at me and said, "Hey, I make films. I don't talk about politics." You know, and I thought that was horrible, actually. You know, so I'm not gonna respond to any question you give me by, "Oh, I don't talk about that." You know, we can talk about whatever you want to talk about. It's fine. Okay. So why protests fail? First, let's look at the question by examining each of the words. Number one, why? Now, when we ask the question why, from an activist perspective, what we're trying to do is we're trying to look for a theory that would be testable by activists. We want to identify some new ways of thinking about social protests that will actually result in concrete victories. Okay, so this isn't just purely an academic discussion. It's not like, well, why is the sky blue? Or, you know, why is there life on Earth? No, this is a concrete discussion about why are the very real protests that we're organizing not achieving the results that we want? And what does that mean about how we should change our behaviors as activists? So number two, what does protest mean? Seriously, this is like something that we don't talk about enough. What does protest mean? I just want to say protest means, for me, a behavior that participants believe will achieve change, social change, and I would even go so far as to say revolutionary change. Okay, so I kind of open it up to that wider definition because I think what I'm trying, part of my message to you is to broaden your horizon about what protest could be. So when we see that it's just a behavior that we believe ourselves to be something that's going to result in change, then all of a sudden you realize, oh. So it doesn't have to necessarily be marching, it doesn't have to necessarily be sit-ins, it just has to be something that we believe, okay? And then fail. Fail, what does that mean? Well, that raises the question of what is success and what is failure. So for me, again, it's very important if we speak and think concretely to say that failure and success from a perspective of protest is at the level of revolution. So what I'm really saying to you when I say why do protests fail, I'm saying, why are these protests that we're doing failing to achieve revolutionary social change? What is revolution? Revolution is a change in legal regime. It's a change in how decisions are made. So why are these things not resulting in for example, a really clear example, for example, in 2003, I was a student, and I went out and I said, I protested the war in Iraq. You know, how come it is that millions of people joined me and others in the streets around the world to protest the war against Iraq that was coming up, and it still happened anyways in a month? Why is that? Why is it that the Women's March can happen and nothing happens after, or Black Lives Matter? Why is that? So when we talk about success and failure, it really is in this much higher plane of a transformation in the way that our governments are run, not in these lower things of getting the word out, changing how people think of things, okay? This is what I'm talking about success and failure. Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you a parable. This is called the Parable of the Three Pigeons. Now, this is based on reality, but I'm going to layer a kind of metaphor on top of it. Imagine that there's three pigeons, each of them placed into a box like this. Obviously, this is a Skinner's box, Skinner box, everyone knows this, okay? So there's three pigeons, and they're each placed into their own box. Inside the box is a lever, and when the pigeon, let's put it the way. So there's three different pigeons. The first pigeon, every time it hits the lever, it gets food, okay? The second pigeon, every second time it hits the lever, it gets food. So it hits the lever twice, it gets food. The third pigeon, there's no connection between the number of times it hits the lever and getting food. It's completely random. So it could be two times, three times, four times. It's just random. It gets the food actually randomly. There's no connection. Okay, so they put them in the box. The scientists put them in the box. And the pigeons learn this, and after a while, the pigeons are feeding themselves. Now, what happens when you disconnect the connection between the lever and the food? What happens? Here's what's really interesting. Now, the first pigeon pecks the lever once, no food comes out. Pecks the lever twice, no food comes out, and just stops pecking the lever. It's like, well, lever's broken, I'm just stopping, okay? The second pigeon does it once, does it twice, no food comes out, does it three, four times, no food comes out, gives up, stops pecking the lever. But what about that third pigeon? That third pigeon just pecks the lever forever. It never stops pecking the lever, okay? Now, why am I telling you about these pigeons, these three pigeons? Why am I telling you about this? This is a metaphor for activism. This is a metaphor for activism, okay? The pigeon is an activist, the lever is a form of protest, and the food is social change. Now, almost all activists, myself included, I'm not putting down activists, I'm saying almost all activists, myself included, are like the third pigeon, which is we do protest behaviors. There's no real connection between the protest behaviors that we're doing and the change that we desire. Sometimes it results in change, sometimes it doesn't, but we just keep hitting that lever endlessly, you know? So the third pigeon doesn't have an accurate theory of social change. It doesn't have an accurate theory about why this food is being released. The second and the first pigeon do have an accurate theory. They know when to protest and when not to protest. They know when the behavior that they've been doing previously that achieved social change stops achieving social change, and they stop that behavior. The second pigeon is like what we the highest we can hope for, which is that sometimes we protest and it works, and sometimes it doesn't, but have a theory for when our failure is because of a broken theory of change, and when our failure is because like we just need to repeat it. You know, like it's fuzzy. And then the first pigeon, of course, is some sort of like perfect revolutionary like Mao, who knew exactly the behaviors that it should be doing. Every time it pushed the lever, it achieved success. I mean, you can count the number of people who have attained this first pigeonhood like on two hands. It's very, very few people. But you know, one thing, for example, with Mao is like, he achieved victory after doing you guys know about the Long March? He marched for 3,000 miles, and that somehow led him to like a revolutionary victory. I mean, how many people would actually think, oh yeah, we're gonna march our army for 3,000 miles throughout China, and then somehow, no, but he had some sort of theory of social change. So the reason why I'm telling you this is that as an activist, you don't wanna be the third pigeon. You do not want to be the pigeon who endlessly hits the lever and then just like thinks that the change is happening because of the lever hitting. We wanna become the second or the first pigeon. Okay. Now, let's let you digest that for a second, and then I'm gonna throw some more ideas at you. What we're gonna do is basically a lot of ideas here, and then we're gonna talk candidly in this conversation. Okay. So we don't want to be the third pigeon. So the first step to not being the third pigeon is to develop a theory of social change. Now, I developed this diagram, this way of thinking about social change, which I think I want to talk about before we get into this question of failure. So we have a kind of way of thinking about it that's a little bit more complex than we often think about it. Okay. So if you think about revolution, then you realize that revolution is basically the interaction between humans and the natural world, just basically speaking. And so if you divide it up, you create four different theories of revolution, why revolutions happen. Okay, so on the bottom half of the diagram, you'll see theories of revolution that say that revolution is a material or natural process. In other words, that revolution is a process involving our natural, our physical, our material world. And then on the top are theories of revolution that say that actually revolution is a spiritual process. It's not something that involves our material or our natural world. On the left hand are theories that say revolution is a process that involves humans. And on the right side are theories that say revolution is a process that does not involve humans. So I call this a unified theory because I think that all theories of revolution fall within one of these four paradigms. So let me go through them really quickly with you. We'll start with the most common theory of revolution is called voluntarism. This is almost all of activist theory right here, says that revolutions are created through the intersection of humans and the material world. Therefore, if we want a revolution, we need to get as many people as possible to do revolutionary behaviors, like marching in the streets or direct action. The action that we're told to do varies, but the basic idea is that human action is somehow crucial and important and a defining factor. You know, so some activists would say today, well, the reason why there's not a revolution happening right now is not enough people are protesting in the streets. Or the reason why the coal factories are still pumping pollutants into our air is because not enough people are blocking the coal factories. It's a voluntarist understanding of revolution. Now, there's an alternative vision, though. What about this idea that revolutions are a process that involve the material world, but don't involve humans? This is the idea of structuralism. And this would be the idea that, for example, revolutions are caused by economic forces outside of human actions. For example, there's been a study that I think is really interesting that said that revolutions tend to occur when there's record high food prices. So record high food prices, so the Arab Spring, this is true for the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street, is that there's actually a UN food price index where you can track the price of food, and it turns out that there's like a threshold. And beyond that threshold, revolutions tend to occur. So the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street both coincided with record high food prices that were induced, by the way, by climate change related storms that knocked up the price of sugar. Okay, so this is not, it's not, it, under this argument, basically, the Arab Spring was caused by something that wasn't really human action so much as forces outside of our control. And for those who are communists or into Marxism, they already understand this. This is historical materialism. This is, you know, the idea that revolution is economic factors and all this kind of stuff. It makes a lot of sense. The third option, though, is that revolution is a process involving humans but not involving our natural world. And this would be the idea that of subjectivism. It's basically the idea that a revolution is a change in our minds. It's a change in how we see the world. So if you want to change how the world is, you have to change how you see the world. I think this is also becoming increasingly common. You know, people who advocate meditation and yoga, we get it. You know, one example I kind of think of is, you know, you break up with your girlfriend and all of a sudden the whole world's like completely depressing and like horrible, and, you know, and the trees are actually crying and all this kind of stuff. Like how we know that, like how we feel inside colors reality, and then all of a sudden we meet someone else and it's like, oh, look at the birds, they're happy. And so under this theory, you know, if we want to liberate humanity, we need to liberate our minds. Okay, so now we're going to go into the most controversial, and I have yet to meet very many people who will, except for Unitarian Universalists, love this one, but theurgism. Now, theurgy is a Greek word, and it means God work. It means sorcery. You can actually go back in the Neoplatonists were very into theurgy and stuff like this. But this is the idea that revolution is not a process involving humans, and it's not a process involving our physical reality. Revolution is instead something else entirely, a kind of divine intervention into our lives. Well, that sounds ridiculous. I mean, you go back and you read Marx. I mean, everyone knows that only secularism is revolutionary, right? Right? So the left has, for a very long time, denied the existence of this fourth option. I'm going to give you two examples of, no, I'm going to give you three examples of theurgy, because I think it's really interesting, okay? Number one example is the conquest of Christianity. Christianity was persecuted for 300 years. Then, I'm going to do this very briefly. Then, Constantine the Great. He wasn't the great back then, he was just Constantine. Constantine the Great, he went to battle against a rival emperor, and the night before the battle, the day before the battle, he looks up in the sky with his entire army. This is in like 312. He looks up in the sky, and he sees a cross in the sky with the words that say something like, "By this sign, you shall conquer." Oh my gosh, what does that mean? He goes to bed that night, and he's visited by a mysterious individual in his dreams who reiterates to him, if you draw this special symbol, it's called the Cairo, if you draw this special symbol on the shields and helmets of your soldiers, you will be victorious tomorrow. He wakes up in the morning. This is historical facts, by the way. This really did happen. This is why the world became Christian. He wakes up the next morning, and he tells his advisors, I had this dream. They say to him, that was Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ visited you in your dreams, and you should do this. And so he did. He put the Cairo, I'm sorry, I don't have an image of it, you can Google it. The Cairo, he put the Cairo, it's like kind of like a cross. He put the Cairo on his soldiers' shields, and they won the battle. And he said, it was because of God, it was because of Jesus. And within a generation, paganism had been outlawed, and Christianity was the state religion of Rome. My point here is, whether or not you think that that story is true, the point here is that someone had a dream about Jesus and decided to convert the Roman Empire into Christianity, and that's why we are Christian apostles. Okay, that's example number one. Example number two, there's a Russian cosmologist in the 19th and the 20th century who linked the existence of sunspot activity with revolutions, and he's found that during periods of peak sunspot activity, revolutions tend to occur. Also sounds like impossible, except Occupy happened to coincide with peak sunspot activity. Now, example number three, I collect these examples because people tell me, you can't talk about God. No. Okay, I'm going to collect third example. Cosmic rays. Now, turns out cosmic rays, which are invisible, we can't feel them, impact our computers. I just read about this, fascinating. And so sometimes when our computer crashes, it's because a cosmic ray has hit the computer in a way that impacts it, okay? Now, I'm not kidding, this is real. There's a documented example of a cosmic ray hitting an election machine and adding 4,096 votes to one of the candidates, who then won the election. And problem is, there weren't 4,096 extra voters. And so they went back and said, well, how did you get you got too many votes? How did this happen? And they really did figure out it was a cosmic ray that flipped like a little byte on the computer and gave them the victory. So what I'm saying is that would be an example of a force outside of our control that could influence the course of political destiny. You know, you can't create a cosmic ray, but I don't know, maybe God could send one down and all of a sudden, that's why we won the election. So the goal there is to say that what I'm trying to say is that all four of those are true, and they're all true. And you don't want to pick just one. This is the problem with a lot of contemporary activism, is that we have just decided that voluntarism or maybe structuralism is the only path, and so we're obsessed with getting humans to do behaviors. But maybe there's something else going on. You want to have all four. Okay. That's actually the last slide I'm going to show you, because like I said, slides are distracting. What's the point? So let's go through, I want to talk about, well, what are the most common theories of why protests fail? And let's see if they're satisfactory. The number one theory, police repression. They say, you know why protests are failing? It's because like the NSA, they've tapped all of our phones, and they have all these police officers, and they just keep beating us up. They won't let us win. This is why protests are failing. I find this one completely unsatisfactory. It doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? First of all, it exaggerates the level of repression that we're under right now. Okay, this is something we like to do as activists, we like to complain about how bad it is with the CIA and the NSA and they're watching our phones, oh my gosh, I'm so scared of them. But look at the reality of past revolutions. Do you think it was any easier for the Lenins and Trotsky under the Russian Revolution to achieve victory? No. In fact, fascinatingly enough, because of the swiftness of the Russian Revolution, they actually captured the secret police spies. Uh-huh. They did. They captured the secret police files of the Tsar. And so we have documented evidence about the extent of police repression immediately preceding the Russian Revolution. And it turns out that there was a lot of repression. It turns out that Lenin's secretary was a police spy. Oh my gosh. It turns out that a lot of the leading Bolsheviks were police spies. It turns out that the Tsar had developed a network of police spies all over Europe who were tracking the Bolsheviks. Look, the Russian Revolution still happens. You see what I'm getting at here? I'm not convinced that it's because of the police repression that we're losing today. Okay, number two theory. Our protests simply are not big enough. We gotta get them bigger. You know, I'm sure we've heard people say it. We just gotta get more people into the streets. Again, I don't think this is very convincing. I think that we all just witnessed the Women's March, which had 4 million people. I don't think that it really would have been more effective had it had 5 million or 6 million or 7 million. I think that there's something else going on here. Another theory, Oh, well, protests don't fail when they're not disruptive enough. We're not getting out, this is very voluntary, so you see, this is why I try to get the unified theory. They're not disruptive enough. We need to get out there, we need to block more traffic. That'll make our protests win. Again, this is not true. This is not true. This what I'm describing here is very much why Black Lives Matter failed. Because Black Lives Matter, which came after Occupy Wall Street, it internalized the wrong lesson about Occupy Wall Street. I think a lot of Black Lives Matter activists came out of Occupy Wall Street thinking, it's because they weren't disruptive enough. I think I heard that a lot, you know? And so they embarked on this kind of like ultra disruptive thing. And you know what? Occupy Wall Street was plenty disruptive, okay? And so it's not about disruption. Okay, here's another one. The lack of demands. This we hear all the time, oh my gosh. Protests fail because they fail to have demands. And this is a critique that was really developed. I mean, it's an old critique, but it really got revived after the anti-globalization movement in 1999, which the anti-globalization movement called itself like the movement of movements. And you would go to anti-globalization protests and it'd be like, save the whales, also reform capitalism, and it'd be like every single leftist cause, and people would make fun of it. They'd say, well, obviously you're not winning, you don't have a clear message, a clear demand. But what happened immediately after the anti-globalization movement was the birth of the anti-war movement of 2003, which had an extremely clear demand, no to the war. It still failed. Okay, so what I'm getting at here again is the experience of activists in America in 1999 to 2003, it doesn't really help us to say that it's a lack of demands. Now we're going to touch on the last common theory, and that's basically it's the lack of leaders. I think we've all heard this one before as well. You need to have leadership in order to have a successful revolution or protest, and that's why they are failing. So, and this was really developed, I mean, this, again, all these arguments are floating around in our consciousness, and then they get like used, deployed against movements. So this was very effectively deployed against Occupy Wall Street, which we explicitly called leaderlessness, leaderless. So they told us, the very thing that you say makes you strong is why you failed. Now, again, I don't agree with this. I think that it's not satisfactory, but what it does point to, which I think is true, is this deeper challenge of decision-making, the ability for social movements to make decisions for themselves and complex decisions for them. And then, you know what? Of these, I think this one does. It's not true that we failed because we didn't have leaders at Occupy Wall Street, but it is true, I think, that we failed because we lacked a kind of decision-making capacity. And I think, I would say, I imagine that decision-making capacity could be developed without leaders, okay? So, you know, the way I kind of think about things is that there's elements of truth in everything. Okay, so I'm saying, you know, we can have a like discussion later. There's elements of truth in all of these things. But I want to get at something more fundamental. More fundamental. There must be something deeper that's going on here about these protests. So I think that the much deeper thing that's going on with these protests is something that I kind of call like the death of sovereignty. Okay? So and I mean this. I was a philosophy major this morning. I don't know if you've been a philosophy major this morning. Alright. Okay. So I mean this in the sense of like Nietzsche's God is dead. Okay? So basically what I'm saying is that if you look at social protests, like what are we doing? Like what are we like doing when we go into the streets and protest? Like what are we doing? Well, what we're doing is we're doing a collective behavior together that we think will manifest a kind of higher form of sovereignty over our governments. See, this is really what we're doing. It's like, for example, I think a really good example to think about is really the anti-war protests of February 15, 2003. So I was a student back then, and what happened in 2003 is that this idea captivated the imagination of activists everywhere. And that idea was, if we can get the whole world to say no to the war, it won't happen. It won't happen because we live in a democracy, and if the people who live in a democracy don't want something, we won't have it. You see? It's a very beautiful idea. I loved it. And I believed it. I definitely believed it. So we all got all of our friends. We ordered, I think we probably had two buses of Swatties back then. I mean, it was huge. And we went to New York City and blocked traffic and, you know, marched and all this kind of stuff. And the war happened anyways. And this, I think, is the fundamental reason why protests fail today. It's the same reason that they failed 13 years ago, which is you can't actually manifest a higher form of sovereignty over your governments through street protests anymore. You may have been able to in the past, but I think that sovereignty in that way has died. And I think that it may have been in its death cycle before 2003, but I think it was definitively killed on February 15, 2003. So what happens that day is that after being protested, George Bush, who was our Donald Trump, everything you think about Donald Trump today, we thought about George Bush back then. George Bush came home and he said something like, so brilliant. He said, I don't listen to focus groups. I don't make my decisions based on focus groups. So basically, the entire world protested, and you guys should Google images of this, you'll see thousands, 100,000 people in London with a sign that just says no to the war. Very clear message. And he got home and he's like, well, that's just a focus group. And you're like, wait a second. It's like, you just had the largest synchronized protest in human history and just called it a focus group. So, and he went to the war a month later. So what I'm saying is, he for the first time explicitly said, Western governments, democratic governments, do not have to listen to people in the streets. And activists from that point forward have failed to really listen to what he said. That was it. He said it, and it's true. It's true. They don't have to listen. There's no constitutional requirement for our governments to listen to protests in the streets. In fact, protests in the streets are a vital and necessary part of the political illusion of democracy. It's part of what sustains American democracy, is to have ineffective and meaningless protests in the streets. That's why Obama and Donald Trump, even to a certain degree, will actually celebrate protests. Because they realize if the protests were to suddenly disappear, I think people would be a little bit more afraid. Maybe we don't live in a democracy. And so they actually function as a legitimating factor. So, but what is sovereignty? What is this thing called sovereignty? Where does it come from? How do you get it? Where does it derive from? This is the direction of so much of my thinking right now, because it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. Here's what I'm gonna think about. And if you're interested in digging into this, you gotta get the social contract by Rousseau. I'm so sad that I didn't read Rousseau earlier in my life. I think that he is brilliant, and he's self-educated, by the way. Very interesting. But he talks about this. So one way to think about it is, like, I have an 18-month-old son, and he's born. He was born at home, actually, in rural Oregon. Very interesting experience. He's born at home, and all of a sudden, the day after he's born, or the minute, second, he is subject to all of the laws of the U.S. government. Isn't that interesting? He has no right to fight those laws. He has to submit to them. And Rousseau was very fascinated with this problem. Like if you were born in Nazi Germany, you would be subject to the laws of Nazi Germany. If you were born in America, you would. So, but how can that be? We didn't get a choice. And so Rousseau develops this whole theory called the social contract. And at the base of that theory is this notion of sovereignty. And so for Rousseau, and what I'm doing right here is kind of tracing why does sovereignty do that, okay? Intellectual history of sovereignty. So for Rousseau, sovereignty derived from basically large numbers of people who live in a place getting together and kind of deciding on general things. Basically, he talks about that they would have this general will, and that would manifest kind of magically this sovereignty, and that decision that they made together would be binding on all of the members. Okay, why would it be binding? He said it would be binding because the participants in that decision-making process would be numerous. He talked about them as being numerous. Like, he talked about assemblies of 20,000 people. So we're not talking about, like, you know, he would say, like, I don't know, there's 1,500 Swaties, so he would say like, you know, 700 Swaties get into a room and have this discussion. He was fascinated with large scale assemblies. They were numerous, they were diverse, and they were diverse and not represented in the sense of spoke for others, but in the sense of all of the different kinds of people in the society were participating in that decision. So for Rousseau, and what's interesting is that Rousseau gets critiqued a lot for being kind of an authoritarian fascist in a way, because for Rousseau, you had no right to resist the decisions of the sovereignty of your community, because the people who made the decision is binding on all of us, because people like us made the decision. So what I'm saying is, for example, Donald Trump, you know, if he wants to get rid of immigrants, well, for Rousseau, he would say, well, you can't actually do that without having immigrants come into a discussion and then decide for themselves that they also want to kick out of the country. So Rousseau thought, well, this is the reason why our governments will never oppress, we can never oppress ourselves, he thought, okay? So over time, though, that vision of sovereignty has narrowed and gotten narrower and narrower. So in the beginning of democracy, like in Athens, like all of the citizens, not all of the people, I understand that, the citizens didn't include the women and the slaves, but they got together in assemblies, large numbers of them, and they decided on everything. And then after that, we got to a situation largely because of the American Revolution, where we started to have representatives. And then after that, we started to just kind of have like governments that were bought somehow by lobbyists. Basically what I'm saying is, successively throughout history, the idea that the largest number of people should be making the decisions that are binding on all of us narrowed until finally we've got to the point where it's like, you know, one single individual named Donald Trump who just signs a form saying. And so if we want our protests to be effective again, and that's what we're trying to figure out, we need to figure out, well, how do we revive this form of sovereignty? How do we create a situation where the people, the numerous and diverse people who live in a society, actually do have the power over their governments? Okay? actually do have that power. Now, if protest was one of the ways in the past that could have happened, and it is no longer one of the ways, then I think, as I see it, we're left with two options. Option number one is that we can win wars. Option number two is we can win elections. That's it. Those are the only two ways that sovereignty in our world is passed along. And so war, which I don't advocate, we have an example of that right now, which is ISIS, and ISIS has sovereignty. Whether or not we like ISIS, whether or not we agree with ISIS's political philosophy, Islamist political philosophy, we do have to acknowledge that they govern territories and create the laws in their territories, and those territories cross international borders, which I think is fascinating, right? It's not like they own just one country, they own like across borders and stuff like that. And then the second option is elections, which is basically what Donald Trump did. You know, he has seized control of our government through winning an election. So social activists have, at this point, we have two options. We can use social protests in order to win elections, or we can use social protests in order to win wars. And it's really, you know, it's up to you. It's up to you. I'm going to tell you, I think we should win elections. I think it's easier. I think that once you start going down the war route, the problem with the war route is this whole, and Professor Smithy brought this up, this whole question of legitimacy. You know, basically, if you win an election, you are the legitimate government. That's just how it works. Whereas if you win a war, or if you fight a war, it's a little bit murky as to which point you become the legitimate government. I think it's a longer and more difficult road. Okay. So what does that mean for social activists going forward? I'm going to tell you my vision and where I think we should go. I think that we need to imagine the birth of a social movement that can win elections in multiple countries in order to carry out a unified global agenda. And the way this would look is a transformation in what it means to protest. Okay, if we and I'm not talking about Bernie Sanders and like electing progressive people to office, because once we start getting into this discussion, people's minds get trapped in these like old ways of thinking about these problems, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, he thinks we should give up on protests and elect Bernie Sanders. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about something else fundamentally different, which is, imagine a social movement that arises just as surprisingly as Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter, but where the way that we protest is literally winning elections. So a concrete example of this, you guys can research, is we have Podemos in Spain, we have the Five Star Movement in Italy, and we have the Pirate Party in Iceland. These are three examples of movements, social movements, that are winning elections. And so we need to kind of import that concept into America. Now, I want to give you just one more way of thinking about it, and then we're just going to like have a bit of a discussion. I'm going to give you one more way of thinking about it. So there was this, I think a really, really beautiful example happened in the Five Star Movement, which really captures what I'm talking about. Okay, so the Five Star Movement, I had the honor and the privilege of going to Italy, and I met with the co-founders of the Five Star Movement. What's amazing about the Five Star Movement is they call themselves a movement, and yet they are like also the third largest political party in Italy, major political force. They're neither left nor right, which is why people really hate when I talk about them, because they're like, no, you can only talk about firmly leftist political movements. Okay, like Podemos, they love Podemos, but Five Star Movement is actually doing better than Podemos. So the Five Star Movement started as an anti-corruption movement. And their basic argument, in Italy they have like parliamentary immunity, so once you get into parliament, you can be like a total criminal, and they can't kick you out. And so the basic argument was like, we need to kick these people out. and so what happened though, is that the Five Star Movement, they started to win a lot of elections, and then last year though, they had a candidate, a woman, a female lawyer, very charismatic individual, who won the mayorship of Rome. Seriously, big deal. But then like a month later, her chief of staff was embroiled in a corruption scandal. He was corrupt. Oh my God, what are you gonna do? And so the Five Star Movement did something brilliant that I think captures exactly what I'm trying to talk about. They didn't do what American political activists do, which is like make excuses, hem and haw, talking points, you know, lying, all this kind of stuff. They just, within 48 hours, were like, oh my gosh, she's corrupt. You know, she appointed someone who's corrupt. We will not tolerate that. And from this point forward, we will make the important decisions for her. Our movement will appoint people for her. She no longer has the power to make political appointments. Okay, this, if you understand the significance of this shift, I think it captures exactly what I'm talking about. So you have a social movement that has elected people into power, but maintained their grip on the people that they've elected into power. They've transformed this mayor into a delegate, not a representative. And she accepted that. She didn't push back and say, oh no, I have the power, I've been elected. She accepted, okay, fine. From this point forward, you tell me what to do in terms of appointments. And so what I'm imagining would be the same thing. What I'm imagining would be a social movement that wins elections but maintains power. And then the decisions would be made, like Rousseau wanted, through this kind of diverse and numerous general assemblies of the people. Now, look, there's a huge problem with this idea. There's a huge problem, there's a big problem, there's the biggest problem ever. We actually don't know how to make complex decisions together. Oh my gosh. And this gets back to the whole thing about Occupy Wall Street and leadership. See, it's not about leadership. It's about the inability of our social movements to make complex decisions together. Like, imagine. Like literally, I mean this literally. Imagine that we had a social movement that wanted to make a decision about what kind of health insurance we should have in this country. Yeah, right. I like to see that happen, right? It's a joke. It would never happen. So the problem I see is that we need to solve, that's the problem we need to be solved. Activists act as if the problem that we need to solve is how to get more people into the streets. No, we're plenty good at that. We're absolutely amazing at it. We are going to continue to see the increase in the size and frequency of social protests. It's easy for us to do this. What's difficult for us to do this is to make decisions as a group together about how to govern our communities. So once we solve that problem, I think that we're going to start to see the effectiveness of protests return. And so that's kind of like where my thinking is going and where I'm trying to push activists is to solve that deeper problem. So thank you so much for listening. I know that was a lot of ideas, and what I want to do now is just kind of like, just open it up, and we're just going to go into wherever you take it, wherever you want to take it. That's what we're going to do. So thank you for listening.